In today's episode,
most people, at least that come to me, are like, you know, I'm thinking about going into this industry, or I'm thinking about doing this. And I always encourage people to sit down and really do a lot of reflecting in terms of first, like, well, what kind of life do I want to have? What's most important to me? What are my values, right? Like, how does that show up every day? And like this notion of like, what would an ideal life look like? You know, do I value challenge, as you said? Do I value being close to my family? Do I value making money? Do I value being in a really important role? Whatever it is, and really doing that like fundamental work at what I would call like the foundational layer before then saying like, okay, I want to go work for a venture-backed startup in the fintech sector in this specific role.
This is Bill Alzaidi, and you're listening to Creator Lab, where I'm learning from the greatest entrepreneurs and change makers of our time. We go beyond the surface to find the nuance in what it takes to turn your ideas into action. In a world of black and white headlines, we're looking for the magic in the gray. We're building an open and respectful community of doers who want to take action by creating. Whether that's a mission to help millions of people through a nonprofit, building a company worth billions of dollars, or changing the world through your art, we are all creators. Now let's get into the show. This episode is sponsored by Squarefoot, where growing companies find their place. They're a new kind of commercial real estate company that understands the needs of growing companies better than anyone else. They've helped over 1,000 growing companies find the right space for their needs without the hassle, uncertainty, and the time suck normally required. They combine technology that minimizes the stressful parts of the search with brokers who are market experts to help you at every step along the way. Visit squarefoot.com/creatorlab to start your search today. Steve,
hey,
thanks for coming on the show, man.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me how I pronounce your surname before I butcher it.
Schlafman.
Schlafman.
So it's, you know, people have butchered it my entire life. And so it's that what I like to say, it's like Schlaf.
Oh, my God. That's the best. So I have Schlafman. The similar thing. I tell people my name's like Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Bill Al.
Yeah.
And I've said that thousands of times. It really works, but people that are around me a lot have heard it way too many times.
Yeah, I've been called Schlafman. I mean, it's just been butchered.
That's
for
it, man.
3 years. Schlafman.
Well, listen, man, thanks for making time to be here. You're someone that I've been following for a little bit of time, and to be honest, without even realizing, because Waleed put us in touch.
Right.
And thanks to Waleed, who's hopefully listening to this, he sent me an email and said, hey, I think you guys would really get on and you'd be a great guest on the show. And then I was like, oh, I didn't necessarily recognize your name straight away. And then I went on Twitter and I was like, oh, yeah, I've been like following you for ages. So yeah, I guess we should probably introduce who you are. You know, in your own words, kind of who are you and what are you working on nowadays?
Sure. So I am a partner at one of the top seed funds here in New York called Primary Venture Partners. We've been around for about 4 years and invest exclusively at the seed stage, specifically in technology companies. And we roll up our sleeves and get dirty on behalf of our entrepreneurs. And about 18 months ago, I decided to dive in headfirst into the executive coaching world. And so I'm now a leadership coach, and I have my own private practice where I work with a very small select few, usually at a time. It's about 5 founders and executives. And so
5 at a time.
Yeah. So I'm part investor, part executive coach. And when I'm not at work and in doing these things, I'm a husband, a father, brother, all the great things.
And actually, I saw that your wife is also an entrepreneur. She is
a
kind of the sale, right?
Yeah. Which so exactly.
We should get her on the show as well. But if she's up for it, I'm a huge fan. Like it's a plant e-commerce business, I guess.
Yeah, so she started a physical store too. Exactly. She started about 7 years ago. She now, you know, ships to all 50 states, has distribution centers in New Jersey and LA, and shops in LA, San Francisco, and multiple in New York, and soon to be more.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So today, you know, thanks for the intro. You've been an investor, but going back, you've also been an operator. You worked at Microsoft for some time back in the day.
Yeah.
You've done so many different things. I did want to call out a few of the investments you've led or been involved with. So some companies people might have heard of, like The Skim, big fan of those guys, Giphy, Bowery Farming, Breva, who's also been on, Julian's been on the show, View to Space. And then before that, Smart Things, what got sold to Samsung, Percolate, a bunch of companies, right? So you've been really a fixture within this space, especially in New York as a VC, as an investor in the startup community for some time. And as you mentioned, you know, you're now doing coaching, which we're going to go into that whole world a little bit later. But I just kind of wanted to take a step back because I've done a bunch of research, you know, listening to some of your other interviews, reading your blog. And I was really kind of fascinated by this tattoo. I know you probably can't whip out your arm right now, but just like I heard you talk about a tattoo you had. And I just love, if you wouldn't mind sharing, I don't know how many tattoos you've got, but this
I'm trying to think of which one.
This one was the Ken Wilber.
Systems
of the Universe.
Yeah.
Just the only reason I wanted to bring that one, because I haven't really heard of anyone having a tattoo like this. And it's just kind of a cool thing that, like, you know, the way you think about the world, I feel like that is kind of ingrained in a little way in this tattoo. So
yeah.
I just would love to hear that.
So the tattoo is a representation of Ken Wilber, who's, I guess you could consider him a modern philosopher. He's written, I mean, volumes of books. And, you know, basically what it stands for is the aqual map. It's all quadrants, all lines. It's extremely esoteric and geeky, but basically it's a lens as to how to view the universe. And so for me, it's a reminder to focus on the sort of the physical self, the mental self, the creative aspects, being part of society, both from a collective and systematic level. So I mean, it's one of these things I would encourage you to link to.
Yeah,
to
I've got actually Exhibit A here. Is this about right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So
yeah.
I know I didn't want to get, because we'll get onto your sling in a minute. But if you're on YouTube, you can see this, and I'll probably we'll put this up as well. But it's really, I haven't actually heard of this before, and when I heard you talk about it, I thought it was really interesting.
So. Yeah, and the way that I sort of used the framing, I actually initially discovered Ken Wilber because I myself am sober. I got sober about 4 years ago. I'm fairly public about it for a bunch of reasons. And I read this book called Integral Recovery by an author that goes by the name of John Dupree, who sort of talked about a holistic view of recovery, and that it's almost like the body, the mind, the social, and the societal. And that in order to get sober, you have to be strong in all four areas. And he linked that back to the map, to the aqual map, Ken Wilber's work. And the whole book is based off of Wilber's work, but applying a lens of sobriety to it. And I thought, wow, this is an incredibly smart way to think about sobriety, as opposed to the 12-step method in AA. And so the deeper that I got into Dupree's work, then led me to Wilber. And so then I was like, wow, this is an amazing lens to sort of view the world.
And if you don't mind me asking, because you mentioned sobriety there. So, yeah. And I've heard you've written about this, or it's publicly on your Twitter. So
sure.
I hope you don't mind me asking. From my understanding, it wasn't necessarily that you said, I'm an alcoholic. Maybe you'd say you're an addict. I'm not sure. But it wasn't necessarily the traditional sobriety story.
Exactly.
So just like, I'd love, since we're on the topic, like, what drew you to that in the first place?
Sure.
And what triggered it?
Well, you know, I think sobriety has been a big part of, I guess addiction has been a big part of my life through family and friends. And I knew that I had the bug from a very young age. I just was, you know, in high school and college and gravitated toward substances.
Okay.
And I'm someone that's always been a pretty high achiever, nearly graduated at the top of my class in college, always held a pretty steady career. But for me, I always gravitated toward substances. Usually at the end of the day, just to take the edge off. And for me, it never got in the way of relationships. My wife and I have always had an amazing, I was highly functional. And I was actually pretty good at covering it up. And I just needed it at the end of every day to sort of take the edge off. And for me, it could have been like two or three drinks, could have been to smoke a little weed, which is obviously becoming more and more popular. And I was never into hard drugs. But for me, it's like I had to smoke at the end of every day to just like take the pressure off and to feel normal. And after doing that for 15 plus years, I was like waking up at every morning, like ready to go to like be a high performer at work or go to the gym. And I just was like, what am I doing? Right? Like I need this stuff to just like get by every day. And I didn't want to live like I want to be a great partner at work. I want to be an amazing husband, eventually become a great father, great son, all of these things. And I was like, you know, these things are only holding
it's
me back
in the way.
Yeah, it's holding me back. And like, frankly, it's now been so again, it wasn't like I there was a world of chaos,
yeah,
and financial
you
ruin.
And you lost your whole life.
Yeah, it was just it like was just... And I actually think there are a lot of people that I would call like functional addicts that like need to use substances to either interact in social situations or just get by every day, even if they're not like down and out. And that was kind of that was my story. And so at a certain point in time, I had to admit to my wife and to people close to me where I was like, look, I think I have a problem. It's not so much a problem where my life is in ruin, but like, I want to have an amazing life and I want to feel normal. And I don't want to feel like I have to use substances to get myself through the day.
That's very brave of you to be able to just cut it off like well, that. And I don't even want to say brave in
no,
a way,
I think
but
brave is a great way to say it. I mean, I think for a long time I was like afraid to admit it to my wife and to other people because I was afraid of the stigma and I had like shame associated with it. I was also having some health issues. Like I was always sick. I had bronchitis all the time. You know, I had really bad heartburn, almost like chronic heart, like a lot of anxiety. And so, like, I'm just like, I don't want to live this way. But at the same time, I don't want to admit to other people that I have an issue. And then finally, I was actually, it was while I was at RRE Ventures. And those guys,
that was the last firm you were
at. That was the last firm where I was a principal. And I left right as I had made partner. And I was actually doing a deep dive into the recovery industry because as part of my job as an investor, you know, there's two ways to make investments. I believe is there's a top down where you have a thesis, right? And you map out a whole space and you go deep in it. And then you eventually find the company or you go bottoms up, which is like way more opportunistic. You don't know who's going to walk in the door. And so I went to my partners at RRE. This was before I got sober. And I said, I know from experience, both through friends and other means, that the rehab, the recovery industry, this was, I mean, almost 5 years ago, is completely broken. And I want to spend the summer doing a deep dive research because I think there's an opportunity to invest, build and or invest in a company. And they were like, great, go nuts. And they let me hire an amazing woman who now runs a consulting. She's ex-McKinsey that's geared towards health and wellness and social enterprises. And she came on board. She was in between her second and third year at Harvard Law School. And she and I basically tore apart the addiction industry and basically published almost a 100-page report on the state of the industry and basically identified a bunch of opportunities. And at the time, there weren't a lot of startups actually tackling this. And now there's been an explosion. But the point that I'll get at is through that work is when I ultimately got the courage to say, like, look, I'm going to go get sober.
That's very interesting, man. I mean, because I think, because you're right, like when you say sober, like if you don't go into the nuance of what that means for you personally, because it's different. There are
it's
people
different
that
for everybody.
Are at the, you know, at their worst place. They're not functioning. They're not going to work. There's all those sorts of things going on. But I feel like that's such a stereotype.
Because I've been high performing my whole life.
And there's actually, and now just thinking to my own personal experience with myself and other people, but just like we find our own crutches, right? Like we have, and you've talked about alcohol and drugs, which is, you know, and to be fair, what you're saying, smoking a little weed, having a drink at the end of the day, is quite a normal.
I wasn't into anything else because I had had friends in high school who sadly had passed away due to opiate addiction. And I had family members who were addicted to other things. And so I was always afraid to touch it because I knew the way that I was wired where it's like, I probably would like it. Yeah. So it was my way of saying like, you know, alcohol, nicotine, that stuff's legal.
Yeah.
Like, and weed is socially acceptable. So I can do those things. But after a while, it just caught up to me. And I think you're right when you say there's a spectrum. And I have a lot of friends that, you know, they will admit that they smoke or drink every day, but it, same thing, highly functional and don't want to do anything about it. I was just at the point where I was like, you know what, I can feel it progressing in me. It's getting worse. I don't like the way that I feel. And so, look, I'm going to own this and I'm going to tackle it head on. And that's not saying it was easy. I mean, it's arguably one of the hardest things I've ever done.
Yeah, yeah. And just the only reason I was going to go into that a little bit more in that there's plenty of people that can have a drink every day or two, smoke a little weed before they fall asleep, whatever their crutch is, right?
Yeah.
Have too much chocolate, have too much food, overeat every day. And, you know, the only reason I mention those other normal examples is because addiction, I think, is more about the mindset of addiction and the problem of addiction. It's not necessarily having a cigarette once every 30 days.
Yeah,
you know, if that was part of your routine. It's just, and there's plenty of people listening to this that do have a drink every day and they're like, well, that's my balance and I feel okay and good for them, right? And that's up to them to decide. But if you could see it in yourself to say, actually, this is gonna go down a negative path and I'm just not my optimal self, then no respect to that, man.
Yeah, and it's like I would wake up in the morning or I'd go to bed at night saying, I'm not going to do this tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
And then I wake up the next morning and the first thing I would think about when I get out of bed is exactly what I said I wasn't going to go do. Okay. That's not to say I was doing it in the morning, but it's just that's the way that my brain worked.
Yeah.
So I was like, I want to have a high performing life.
Yeah, I wanted to ask because people watching this on YouTube, if you're listening to this, you can't see this, but you're wearing an arm sling.
Yeah,
you've hurt your shoulder, and we don't have to go into the full story. But from my understanding, this was a cycling accident, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that I've picked up over the last 4 years, as I was embracing a much more health, I've always been fairly healthy, I've lived an active life. But I picked up cycling because it's outdoors and you can explore a lot. It's just a great, great sport. And about 3 weeks ago, I had a nasty crash up in the Catskills and severely fractured my left collarbone, and that required surgery. So I'm sitting here as a bionic man with a plate of 9 screws in my shoulder.
Well, thanks for you setting off the metal detectors at the airport,
man.
But no, the reason I brought that up was because often I've met a couple of people who have replaced their addictions with other sorts of addictions. That might be healthier addictions, if you want to call them addictions.
Yeah.
I don't know what we would define that as. But for example, is cycling or meditation or yoga, which I've heard you talk about, do you feel like you're obsessive sort of nature, if that's an accurate word to use, I would say the same about myself. Is that part of the addiction/obsession that you're now applying in a more positive way?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to characterize it. So there are a few concepts that I think might be worth introducing that I work with some clients on, which is there's, to your point around replacement, there is almost like I forget the exact terminology, but for most people that have an addiction or those that have addictive tendencies, when they quit something, they usually replace it with something else. And so there's like a replacement factor. And so in my case, I think it was probably ice cream, meditation and working out.
Yeah.
And
it's a good combination.
Yeah. And the other thing is there's a concept known as the cornerstone habit, which is to say that not all habits are designed equal and that certain habits actually lead to more beneficial behaviors. And so, for example, you know, by me stopping alcohol and smoking marijuana, that allowed me to then focus on doing other things. And so waking up in the morning and exercising. Yeah. And by me waking up and exercising every morning before work, I started to feel incredible.
Yeah. Then you're addicted to that feeling.
Yeah, right? And then I'd want to eat well throughout the day. And
so the cornerstone is that first big step, right?
Well, the cornerstone, I guess, in the case would probably be waking up early and exercising. And by waking up early and exercising, then it leads to like all these other things.
It's like a domino effect.
There's a domino effect.
I'm the same. I have the same when I, for me, it's always eating really healthy and clean. So everything else is 10 times better when I really focus. Of course, I need to have some balance, but I'm quite an extreme person too. So for several years, I've been like experimenting with, you know, all sorts of different food and nutrition and diets and stuff like that. And last year, I was probably the most extreme. And people that have watched this for some time will know me that I lost a bunch of weight last year and got healthier.
Doing what?
I did a bunch of different stuff, but it was really just cleaning up the food, making that the first pillar. So I basically just focused on nutritional density. I ate probably 2 meals a day. I did intermittent fasting. I exercised more. You know, all the kind of standard stuff. But, you know, cut out processed food, most refined carbs, focused on good quality vegetables. So just kind of obvious stuff, but it's the old saying about everyone knows how to get six pack, but none of us do, right? Most of us don't. And it's knowing is not that hard, it's doing. So
yeah,
that was the big difference.
Before my injury, I was almost predominantly on a paleo diet this whole year.
Okay, yeah.
So basically only whole foods.
Yeah. You still eat like that now?
I'm not, because I can't cook with my shoulder. So I've been eating like shit.
Yeah.
But I've actually been thinking about, because I can't cook, it's just hard to maintain that diet and be so disciplined.
Yeah,
right?
Really plan ahead.
It's tough, and I wouldn't want to put that burden on my wife. And so what I'm doing now is I haven't kicked it off, but I'm considering intermittent fasting for the first time, just because I'm not exercising and I'm not on my paleo regimen.
Yeah. So the way I eat is probably close to paleo. I don't necessarily call it strictly paleo, but and before I've done like keto before. I've tried vegan for a bit and didn't really like it. And I think, again, not to bore people with the details of everything I eat every day, but just I found for intermittent fasting specifically, when I'm eating less refined carbs, that's the biggest difference for me. So when I'm just having like salads and vegetables and meat and chicken and fish, like I could go 18, 19 hours without wanting to eat, which is fine. And then I still have similar number of calories, but I just kind of like get used to it. I have black coffee in the morning, I have some green tea.
Yeah, black coffee was what I struggled with the most.
Yeah. Well, that was a good little tangent. I'm enjoying that. But just to for the sake of time, I did want to actually mention, so you're a prominent New York-based VC. We're also based in New York right now together. I want to thank Listening Party and Canal Street Radio for hosting us today in New York. But you didn't grow up here, right? So
no.
Tell me about that. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up just about 20 miles north of Boston in a
New
small
England.
Little suburb, very, very closed off community, Swampscott, Massachusetts.
Swampscott,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, so I guess Swampscott is not well known, but I think if you were to look at the Wikipedia page, it has two claims to fame. One is the founder of GE, or one of the founders of GE, lived there, and the dory, basically the rowboat, was invented there.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, so I mean, it's...
What's it like, though? What was it like growing up? You're a twin, too, right?
I'm an identical twin, yeah. My twin brother's a director of product at Netflix. So it was actually comical growing up as a twin, because he and I were very badly behaved. We were terrors in our town, still infamous. We go home and people will run into old teachers and parents of friends, and they'll say, "We thought you guys would be in prison by the time you were 20.
That's interesting. Did you get in trouble at school? Like,
we got in trouble all the time until we were basically in high school, and then we really turned it around. But we he and I fell in love with really two things when we were younger. One was video games. So our parents, we never even really asked for it, bought us a Nintendo in 1985. and we just fell in love. And so he and I were pretty much obsessed with video games up until the time we were, you know, in college. And then, of course, like, you know, he was always an amazing artist. Despite us being identical twins, we're very different. And so he was always an artist, and I was just someone that was always incredibly social. And so that, you know, his superpower, he's very much an introvert, and I like to say I'm an extroverted introvert. But it was an amazing upbringing. But, you know, we loved games and sports, and that's ultimately how we got into technology. Both of us, when we got into our professional careers, it wasn't even a question of what we would do. It was always like, okay, we're going into technology.
Did you start? You studied like business or marketing? Or
yeah, what? I study business. It's interesting because initially I thought I was going to go to school to become a teacher. My second love, aside from video games, was actually sports. And so I thought when I first went into school, I thought I was going to become a teacher and a coach.
Oh, right. That's funny.
Just because I've always loved working with people and getting performance. And it's actually interesting. I think in my high school yearbook, they said that I was going to be the head coach of the local football team.
Yeah, not the Patriots.
Not the Patriots, but my high school team. And so when I got to school, that's what I thought I was going to do. And then very quickly, it became clear that my passion for technology, and I became a lot more interested in business, and then quickly enrolled in the School of Business. I went to Northeastern University in Boston, and then Northeastern is an amazing, amazing school. So you go to school for 6 months and you work the other 6 months. So by the time you graduate, you have at least about a year and a half of real world experience. And that's the way that the program was always structured. And to me, when I was looking at schools, it was always like, well, why aren't all schools structured this way? And so it just dawned on me that was the right model for education. And so while I was there, I actually had a number of amazing internships, one of which was with Microsoft.
And this what year was this?
This was dating myself now. You're making me seem old, but this was 2001, 2002.
So the reason I mentioned, because that was Microsoft was the king employer.
Before Google went IPO, right? Google did an IPO for at least like three or four years after that. You know, Apple had just launched the iPod.
So it was, okay. Yeah, and Microsoft, I remember even for when I was going to school, which was a few years after, Google became like a really good employer, like one that people wanted to apply to. But even when I was graduating, it was like people wanted to go into finance still.
Oh, yeah, that was the era. It was
and
all
then,
finance.
And then a big crash happened, and then everyone was like, oh, what's this internet thing? And luckily, I always liked the internet, so it kind of worked out. But it was just like, it's interesting because I think for the younger listeners who don't necessarily know the full history of Microsoft, obviously, we've all heard of Microsoft, but Microsoft was the place you wanted to work in big tech.
It was extreme.
And now they've made a crazy comeback as well in the last few years,
which has been incredible to watch. Because I towards the end of the Ballmer years, I sold all my stock because I was just so frustrated for a whole bunch of reasons. Sold Microsoft stock and bought Apple stock.
Oh, really? Well, it probably worked. Well, it depends when you bought it.
Yeah, but I wish I had bought it back because Satya's done such an amazing job. Yeah.
I do want to ask about, you know, we're going to go into some of the techniques and exercises and tools that you use on yourself and with founders that you work with in a little bit. But before we get to that, I do kind of want to hone in on, you know, you were working at Microsoft, you worked at startups as well, you know, what people often call an operator, you know, you're working within an actual company, startup, and then you switched over to the investing side. Like, how did you know that was what you wanted to do? Because I've read that you said when you started doing it, you're like, this is it. This is what I should be doing.
Yeah.
And that is something that 99% of people listening to this don't ever get that feeling.
Well, right? It's so funny. It was almost by accident. So I was at Microsoft for 4 years. I then moved to New York, and I was working for a startup called Massive, which basically was serving advertisements into video games. And about a year into my time at Massive, I had a really unique opportunity, literally land on my lap to go work for the Kraft Group up in Boston. They own and operate the New England Patriots.
And I'm taking it. You're a fan.
I've been a lifelong Patriots fan. And both through the bad times and obviously the last 20 years, it's been a good run. But in that, as part of that job, I met with the Crafts and they were describing to me what the role was. And they said part of it is going to help us evaluate some investment opportunities. And so while I was going through the interview, I actually give this advice to anybody that's interviewing for any role, which is this notion of come bearing gifts. And so I said to the Crafts, I said to Robert and Jonathan, well, let me start working for you for free.
Oh, wow.
If there's anything that you want me to help with, just send it to me and you can get to see how I work. And you can make an evaluation based on that. And so they had actually sent me a few business plans of potential investment opportunities. And so I then, did the work on those, sent it to them, and then eventually got the job. And then it turned out about 40% of my job was actually helping them evaluate fund investments as well as venture investments. And that was when I, even though I had been in technology the previous 6 years of my career, this was my first foray into really evaluating startups at the earliest stages.
So you weren't especially, what was the role advertised as
that it
you
was, even applied it was, for? I think the role started out as, I think I was senior analyst of the Kraft Group. So it was basically just evaluating a bunch of different opportunities. But then it turned into, I sold a seven-figure sponsorship to Fox Business. I helped broker a big partnership between the Patriots, the NFL, and Buddy Media, which was a local startup in New York. And so I was instrumental in bringing Patriots onto Twitter and Facebook and other things.
So this is what year is this? This is like
so this was 2007.
Yeah,
2007, 2008. Yeah. And that's not to say I did all the work, but in terms of like going and brokering the partnership with Buddy and helping get the handles and all that stuff. Yeah. So it was this amazing role where it was investments, incubations. We looked at making a bunch of acquisitions that we ended up not going through, and then just random sort of operating projects throughout the business.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like a very hybrid sort of role, not just like investing role, not just your deal making, you're doing all sorts of stuff. It's kind of a cool, especially if you're a New England Patriots fan it's like I'm a big Arsenal soccer fan.
So it'd be the equivalent of you going to work for Arsenal.
Oh my God.
And the thing
maybe
that,
not right now.
Well, the thing that was interesting is when I joined the Kraft Group, I thought that I wanted to sit at the intersection of digital media and sports. And the more that I dug into startups and the ecosystem, and at the time I was in Boston, we had made a number of investments in New York. So I've been investing in the New York ecosystem now for over a decade. But that it became very clear to me that that's where I wanted to spend my time. And what I realized that even though I was a fan of the Patriots, my passion really laid more towards the startups and technology. And it was also a really interesting time because I joined right as the first iPhone was being launched, but pre-App Store.
Oh, okay.
And so to see that whole wave has been just... And then I moved to New York and I joined Lair Ventures, which is New York's most active seed fund. And that also happened by accident where I was on Twitter and saw Ben Lair post, we're hiring a principal to help us run our fund. And I had been, as I said, I've been investing in New York for a while at the time. And so I had developed some good relationships and then ultimately landed
what
there.
What makes a good investor, like at that seed stage? Like what are the characteristics they're looking for normally?
Yeah, I think it comes down, I think seed investors tend to be, I like to say my job is to be more of a talent scout than a financier. Okay. And so I think it's...
It's so early that you're just really taking a bet on the person.
The people, and I also think that most of the, I think... Outsiders might view the venture game as looking into the future and having a crystal ball. But I honestly believe that really understanding why the product is solving a problem today and why that initial wedge into the market can lead to a big and fast growing outcome. Yeah. And so to me, I think that it's all about being able to spot talent, but it's also about understanding the present and the current environment, and then really, really believing in the market.
Mm, okay.
And then, of course, the go-to-market and the strategy.
Yeah. Well, that kind of transitions us onto, you know, what you're doing right now, which is, of course, investing. But I read, let me see what I wrote down here. On your website or maybe on Primary Venture site, it says, Steve's mission is to be the most human-centric investor in NYC by helping talented founders become exceptional leaders. Yeah. Really love that because, you know, just meeting a bunch of investors, like they all need to often bring something else that other people aren't, or like at least differentiating in some way, right? Because sure. It's not just money that you're bringing to the table as a fund. You're bringing your expertise, your connections, your network, all that sort of stuff. And I can tell just like going through your stuff that you genuinely, you know, really care about, first of all, improving yourself and then helping other people.
Yeah, serving other people is one of my core values. Yeah. And so for me, it's actually a big reason why I ended up at Primary. Having worked for a number of institutions, I had never seen a firm work so hard on behalf of the founders. And to me, that was just such strong alignment with my view of the world.
I was curious to hear, you know, how you think about, you know, the term, you know, we talked about your past, sobriety, all that sort of stuff. And a lot of the time, you know, to some people that sounds like we're doing therapy, right? There's nothing wrong with therapy. We're going to come to that in a second. But, you know, and to me, therapy is something that is now in the last few years, more people are becoming open to it. But there's still such a huge resistance to that word. And I also feel similar to the word coach. And not necessarily, if you say a soccer coach, a football coach, a sports coach, you'll be like, okay, cool. They're coaching a team. That makes so much sense. When you say the term career, executive, business, life coach, which is a whole different sphere, I feel like that the term itself, there's a lot of resistance to from a lot of people that would probably gain a lot from it. And I'll be honest, I've probably felt that as well. And in my old job, I ended up being paired with what was called an executive coach, but essentially, he ended up being a hybrid of a great sounding board, someone who's trained in understanding and seeing blind spots that I wasn't going to see, that my friends weren't going to see, my parents weren't going to see, and being able to kind of guide me in a way that wasn't necessarily saying my whole life's terrible. My life was pretty good, right? It was just saying that what are the things you're trying to improve, because everyone's always trying to improve something, and are there things that we can do to make that a lot more effective and efficient? So I found an incredible transformational experience working with him. I only had 6 sessions, and he was a great guy. So the only reason I bring that up is just because I think the word coaching and therapy, to me, there's kind of like a similarity in that there's a resistance, but it's so valuable to so many people. And I find, and again, tell me if I'm wrong here, but to me, therapy seems more about dealing with the past,
yeah,
in many ways.
Sure.
Maybe there's some therapists that are helping you figure stuff out going forward too, but really it seems like there's all this unconscious bias, this these subliminal things that we haven't thought about for so long that it just, you know, like the time you fell over as a 9-year-old and like someone took the ball away from you at school and you didn't deal with it, and now that's manifesting itself. And that sounds so cliche, but genuinely a lot of us are living with those crutches. But coaching, or just if we've used the term self-development, growth, you know, working with someone to grow yourself, like that to me is really seems more as about today and going forward. Would you say that's an accurate statement?
I think I probably couldn't articulate it better than you did. I mean, I really think that coaching is extremely forward-looking and also outcome-driven. And so, you know, I can just speak to how I work and certainly how I work with my coach, but at the end of every session, it's very clear of what I want to do in order to tackle whatever it is that's in my way or where I want to go. And it's very, very clear on how that coach is going to hold me accountable.
So you still have a coach now, right?
I do.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, although Andrew, who's amazing, his name's Andrew Taggart, You should link to him in the show notes. He wouldn't call himself a coach. He's actually a philosopher. He's a PhD in philosophy.
Oh, he literally is.
He's and so he wouldn't even call our time together coaching sessions. He calls them philosophical conversations.
Love that.
I actually have one on Wednesday, and I'm really looking forward to it. But at the end of the day, it's using logic and really digging 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 layers deep. Yeah. And I find that with him, I do amazing work. But again, it's very outcome-driven.
Yeah. And that's awesome, man. So I would just add to that to say there's a lot more conversations around this topic. And there's a book that just came out recently, Eric Schmidt, the ex-CEO, and I guess he's still the chairman of Google.
Yeah, the trillion-dollar coach.
Have you read that yet?
I have.
Okay, how is it?
I liked it. I think I may have had unrealistic expectations, thinking that it was going to be a life-changing book. But, you know, at the end of the day, Bill Campbell was one of the greatest coaches that ever lived and really served some of the top tech organizations in history, you know, Apple, Google.
Yeah, and I heard that just for people, for context for people, Eric Schmidt, obviously really well-established guy, and I heard him on, I think, the Tim Ferriss podcast. He gave a talk about this, and I was like, wow, like, you know, I was at Google for 7.5 years. I've seen Eric Schmidt was one of those people that, like, in the beginning, I was like, I wasn't even sure about him. And then the more I saw him, I was like, this guy's on top of his game. Like, you'd see him speak in front of a crowd, and he was like a mixture between a politician, but like the good parts of a politician that I actually like, and the, you know, the clear thinking of a, like, a philosopher and kind of like the technological brains of a real technologist. And when I heard that, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And I just found that, again, the word coach, like, a lot of people just still feel resistant towards. But when you start thinking of, you know, people like him and, you know, people like yourself who, and when you go to the gym or you go to any sort of organized sport, you're going to have to get help from people that they're not necessarily better than you at the sport, right? Like, LeBron James' coach is not better than him at basketball, but he's a better coach than he is.
I think the analogy that Eric Schmidt used was when, don't quote me on the story, but I think John Doerr, the famous VC, encouraged Eric to meet with Bill Campbell about being his coach. And I think initially Eric was reluctant. And I think the analogy that Eric ultimately used was, you know, Andre at the time, I think Andre Agassi was one of the top tennis players in the world. It's like Andre Agassi needs a coach. And so to me, I don't view having a coach as a weakness. I actually view it as an investment in myself, and that I'm able to work with someone who's completely neutral, that shows up with no judgment whatsoever, and helps me become the best version of myself. And I try to do the same with my partners. I mean, I hate using the word client, because at the end of the day, these are people that I partner with to help them achieve whatever it is that
they want to achieve.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
their visions.
And I think the other thing is, like, any kind of service offering, if you want to call it that, like, there's going to be a range of people, right? Like, there's going to be Bill Campbell, that guy, and there's going to be, you know, there are some people that are less experienced. And again, not to say that the intention isn't good, but someone might have gone to a coach or, you know, tried to get help in this way and had a bad experience. But I guess to that point, there's such a range of people out there. So I think that if you are still listening to this and you're resistant to this concept, I would just urge you to have a listen and see if there's something that you can still gain out of it.
Yeah, and I would just venture to say, like, I'm still at the very beginning of my coaching journey. I've been doing this for about 18 months. I love the work. The thing about coaching, his name is Tony Stubblebine. He runs coach.me, and he runs one of the most popular publications on Medium called, I think it's Better Humans. And Tony's an amazing guy. You should have him on the show. And he asked me when I finished my coaching program, what was the biggest surprise? He's like, what was the biggest surprise? And that was the only thing he asked me. And I think it was over Twitter. And I was like, here's the guy that runs coach.me. He's like, runs better humans on Medium. And so I wanted to, like, try to, like, come up with the perfect answer. And so I was like, you know what, I'm not going to answer him right away. And then I started thinking about it, and I was like, you know what, the depth and breadth of the coaching profession is like mind-bending, meaning that you can take a coaching 101 certification course, but you're only skimming the surface, because coaching is one of those fields that's multi or interdisciplinary. So it's everything from psychology, neuroscience, history, philosophy. I mean, it factors in all of these different fields in a really interesting way. And so that's the thing that gets me most excited about coaching, is that it really is, it feels like it's never ending. And because I focus more on the executive side, you know, to me, there's on one end of the spectrum, which is what I would consider like pure transformational coaching, which is the school that I went through. And so that's more or less like, you know, I think what people would consider kind of like the woo-woo world of coaching, which is like really like going into your body, being in the moment, really looking at your emotional state, and then in order to figure out where you want, and then using a whole range of tools in order to get the client in moving in the direction that they want to go in. That's one end of it. Then the other is like the hardcore business coaching, which is like, I think really what people would consider it is more as like consulting or advising. And so I think for me, I'm passionate about both. And that's not to say like most coaches actually don't give advice. And so in a coaching session for me, if and when I do, I make it very clear where I say, hey, look, I'm going to take my coaching hat off for a second. And so I make it very clear when I'm giving advice versus actually being the coach and just asking lots of really thoughtful questions and bringing them into a place that they can feel really good about so they can take action.
So I think for people listening, that's kind of like the foundational part on, you know, why coaching in the first place. And I think we've discussed that now. So I think what will be useful is if we kind of take a few examples, and maybe just we can kick it off by like, what does that framework look like to you? Like if someone was coming in today, you know, what is the typical sort of person you work with, and how does that first few conversations go?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah. So typically I work with CEOs that, this isn't a hard and fast rule, but tend to be solo founders.
Okay.
So they don't have co-founders, and they're looking for a neutral party to help them on their journey. And so that's a common theme, though. It's not common through the five partners that I work with, but it...
And that's a part of your focus.
Yeah, exactly. And what I would say is these are people that know that they're high performing, right? They're very capable leaders, and they know that they just don't want to go on the journey alone. And they often know where they want to go, but they just need help deciphering the map. And so I like to use the analogy of, you know, when I was climbing Mount Rainier, right, I was strapped to a guide that had a headlamp on. And, you know, and to me, instead of me being the guide in front, I let them be the guide, but I'm right behind them. And so you can't see all the way to the summit, but that we're slowly navigating up and down up the mountain towards the summit. And the further up we get, the more visibility that there is. And the way that we get visibility is by me asking a lot of questions. So how does that show up in practice? So typically when I work with a client, the first session, you know, there's before the first session, there's a full questionnaire, that goes into their past and then also the future. Then usually it's about a 90 to 120 minute session.
In one go straight away?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, usually it's up to 2 hours, and we dig into the questionnaire. And that's where we really set expectations. And the whole idea behind that is what I refer to as like creating a conscious relationship. So it's not just really understanding who the client is through that one session, but it's also... how's the relationship going to work, right? How do we know if it's working in the future? how do we celebrate our wins? What if this isn't working? How do we deal with that? So you're basically getting out.
It's like a contract almost.
Yeah. And it's a way to just set the stage. And then from there, you know, I think it's, for me, it's a minimum of 6 months in order to really get the best results. And so that's basically, and then we just hop in and we do the work. And so, you know, I've worked with clients on a range on everything from, you know, bootstrap founder that's been working in the business for 10 years, has all of the fire in the belly to keep on going, but wrestling with big strategic questions, right? But it really varies. And then, you know, my work as a coach also, I get a lot of friends and acquaintances that are just coming to me for help. And so just doing one-off sessions.
So maybe I'll give an example of something that just from my experience, like even myself and other people have, like, I don't want to say the word complain, but they've said, like, they've got to a juncture in their career and they're like, okay, I don't know what to do next. Or they've, like, lost purpose. So maybe I'll just give a personal example. Yeah. So I was at Google for almost seven and a half years. I moved several times. I was in Dublin, then London, then New York. And each time, what drove that move was I felt like my learning curve, so to speak, had slowed down, right? Sure. So after 2 years, I was like, I'm loving it. It's great, great, great. And then I was like, okay, I'm doing the same thing. I'm not really learning anymore.
And what was going on that led you to believe that?
I guess that's a good question. I guess for me, it was I was comparing myself to the first, let's say, 6 to 12 months to the last 6 months. So in the beginning, I was just mentally stimulated. I'm learning stuff I didn't know about. And then by the time it came towards the end, I was like, I could do this job like with my eyes closed. Sounds really stupid.
And at that point, what were you looking for? And then what was not being fulfilled?
I think one, it was just like feeling like I was mentally stimulated, like that I was kind of getting bored of the work. And also I was looking for a bigger challenge.
You were looking for more mental stimulation and bigger challenges.
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
And that wasn't, those needs weren't being met in that situation.
Yeah. And then another thing, which was kind of a life thing. I was living in Dublin, Ireland at the time, and my family were in London where I grew up. So that was a big driving point as well. So I ended up finding a way to
A need to get closer to family.
Yeah, exactly. So those, and that was one move. And then I did a second equivalent of that, moving to New York. And that was 6 years ago now. So there's been several moments like that, and I'm sure everyone listening to this has 10 examples of that in their own lives. But just like the most common thing I've seen, especially at a company, and this isn't official, but this is just my experience, especially my friends at Google, and by this point I have thousands of people that I've met and worked with at Google in all of those different offices. And there was kind of this phase that I saw that people were so, especially in Dublin in the beginning, because there was all this young, ambitious, bright-eyed, you know, 20-something-year-olds. We all moved to Dublin. 80% of us moved there for the job. 20% or so were from Ireland. Still also, everyone was super smart. And then we kind of got to that point where you don't get as much responsibility as you think you'd want, you know. And that's not necessarily just at Google. That might just be like a millennial issue, I guess. But the problem is you put a bunch of people who are all, you know, most of those people are top of their class. They're willing to put in the work. They'll do these 20% projects on the side, which is basically 120% projects. Right. So, like, you know, we're all competing with each other, and you're basically then marked on a curve, right? Because there's a bell curve. So 20% of people have to be in the bottom 20%, right, even if they're doing a good
job. That's how Microsoft was.
Exactly. So at that point, you just start to think, well, this is stupid. Like, I'm still doing a great job. Why am I even getting to this point where, like, you stop comparing yourself. You don't want to compare yourself to other people, but you naturally are, because you're being judged amongst each other. And so that was a long way of saying that I felt that at Google, even though I had a great time there, by the time I left, I was way overdue. I should have left probably a year or two before. Exactly. So is that, like, if someone else was in that situation, what would you ask them to be looking out for?
So it's actually, it's a really good. As I was listening to you talk, a few things were coming up for me. One is, I have worked with several executives in transition. So there was one product leader here in New York that was leaving a really well-known startup here in town, and she knew that she was going to be in a transition. And so she and I worked very closely together through that transition to help her identify, first really define what was most important to her. And so I call these clients executives in transition. These tend to be shorter stints because it's usually around like, okay, help me think through
my next step.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually am in the process, though I need to do this. I have a blog post that's sitting in draft, so it's probably like 25% of the way there about what to do if you're thinking about making a transition in your career. And to me, like, I always think that most people, at least that come to me, are like, you know, I'm thinking about going into this industry, or I'm thinking about doing this. And I always encourage people to sit down and really do a lot of reflecting in terms of first, like, well, what kind of life do I want to have? What's most important to me? What are my values? Right? Like, how does that show up every day? And like this notion of like, what would an ideal life look like? You know, do I value challenge, as you said? Do I value being close to my family? Do I value making money? Do I value being in a really important role? Whatever it is. And really doing that like fundamental work at what I would call like the foundational layer before then saying like, okay, I want to go work for a venture-backed startup in the fintech sector in this specific role.
Have you, so the blog post, I know we don't have it to reference right now. Are there, because what I love on your blog, you've got one blog post recently or a few months ago that was about doing an end of year review.
Yeah.
And it was really great. I'll link to it in this post, in this podcast notes. But that what I love is you gave real tangible, you know, examples of what you did, like you actually stack ranked a bunch of, you know.
The post is very similar. Okay. The spirit behind, again, I'm still getting started, but the spirit behind it is very much the same.
Yeah. So I guess what about for you, though? If we were saying a time where you were going through transition and you were giving yourself advice, and what would that be without referencing the blog right now, which we can't share? Like, are there a few, you just gave a few examples of like, what you care about, and that those are like starting questions. But then, you know, playing devil's advocate, right? Someone listening to that might say, well, yeah, of course I care about all of those things, but like, what do I do with it now?
You right. know? Yeah. And I think like, depending on those questions, like it's a pretty long list of questions that are in this post, but like, let me give you an example. What kind of work environment do you want to be in part of, right? Like, what do you want to be in an open office environment? Do you want to be in one where, you know, that's incredibly strict? Do you want to be one where you can work remotely? Like, there's, I mean, nowadays, like, work has changed so much that there's a lot that can be considered. But I think getting back to the heart of your question, like, for me, if you're going to play devil's advocate, like, that's fine. It's like, okay, at the end of the day, the rubber meets the road. I need a job and I need to earn an income. And to me, it's like my own career has always been like, I have a base set of skills or superpowers, right? Or strengths. How can I leverage those to go into an area that can leverage my previous skills and my existing strengths, and then be able to build a whole new set of strengths? So like, let me give you an example. My first job at Microsoft was part of venture integration. This was the team that integrated the acquisitions, right? Like, got my foot in the door at Microsoft. This was my 6-month internship. And then went back to Microsoft. I spent 2 years in a leadership rotation program, where every 6 months I rotated into a new area of finance, similar to like GE has their world-class program, Microsoft has something similar. So then I built, you know, 6 different jobs in 2 years. I built a massive network, right? Very, very different like experiences. Then I spent 2 years doing strategy and M&A. Unlike anything I had done previously in those four rotations, but like expanding my skill set. Yeah. Then I did strategy.
So trying many things.
And then really I went to strategy and network projections at Massive, right? Very different, but related. And then I went to the craft group, and then that. And so the point is like, I always recommend that people always like go out, like leverage what they've done, but sort of go slightly outside. And so I basically have become a jack of all trades, but a master of none.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that that's where the world is going right now. And I would say the same for myself. Like one of the reasons I do this podcast is to learn from all sorts of people, not just tech, not just startups, but I've had people that are in Hollywood and nonprofit founders and all sorts of stuff. And to me, the kind of underlying principle is they're all going through a similar process, but the more breadth of experience you can pick from, the better you're going to be in making your own decisions.
And right? And honestly, something you just said about like breadth of experience, my job as a coach is to help my partners think through and actually like realize that there's a lot more possibility in the world than anyone believes, and that we're capable of doing more than we believe. And so how would that show up in my life? When I left RRE Ventures, I took a little bit of time off, and I had in my mind, I was like, well, there's only a number of paths, right? I could start my own fund, I could join a fund, I could go into coaching full time. And that was kind of it. And you know what? I did myself a disservice. Right. So if I were giving myself the advice or coaching, right, like the advice I would give my former self is you have way more possibilities, right? Like,
how do you find those possibilities though? Like, is there something that you could, I mean, like, where do you need to look to be able to understand? Because often you get so stuck in, like, you know, that frame of mind where you're like, well, this is what I do. There's a few people I know that did what I did. What are they doing?
So what I would have done is actually just increase the number of people I was talking to by like, I would have been a lot more curious. Okay. And that would have been the word that I would have really attached to. And so instead of saying like, I'm going to go start a fund with a partner and that's what I'm going to do, or I'm only going to talk to one or two funds, I would have said, you know what? I'm going to take the next 3 months and just have a lot of exploratory conversations and say, you know what? I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to learn. And I'm going to use every opportunity to say like, is this a fit for me? While fleshing out all of that, the like, what kind of life do I want to have? What's important to me? Is it making the most amount of money? Is it doing XYZ? Is it purpose and meaning? Is it saving the world? Whatever is.
And the way I've thought about it in the past, what you just mentioned there, I've always, I didn't invent this, of course, but just I've read this somewhere once that there's kind of three things you're looking for in a job or your career. And I might not remember all of them. One is what you're passionate about, let's say. One is what you're good at, which isn't always the same thing. Like, I might be passionate about playing soccer, football, but like, I'm not going to be
playing for Arsenal.
Yeah. So passion, what you're good at. And then the third is, does the market pay for it? And there's always, there might be a fourth one as well that some people use, but I like to simplify it with that. And every time I've gone into a new situation, I've kind of weighed them up. And the truth is, it's hard to get 10 out of 10 on all three of those scales, right? So like, I'll just give one example. When I moved to Charity Water, right, I was looking for more purpose in my career. I wanted to say to myself in many years, oh, I had the chance to work at a nonprofit that just gave people a better life. It's pure giving. And that was a 10 out of 10 on the scale of in that regard, right? And was I good at it? I'd say I was probably quite good at it because I got the job and I was like uniquely positioned to do that role. Does the market pay for it? Yeah, and I can't complain. They were really amazing employer in that way. Does it pay the same as working in the private sector? Maybe not, right? But on that scale again, the other two things outweigh that third part. So in that particular moment in my life, I said, well, this matters, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm on a 12 on these other two areas. And as long as I'm still happy on the third part, then this is an amazing opportunity, right? And then as I kind of look every year, I kind of reevaluate like that. Do I still feel a 12 out of 10 on the first couple points, or has that now nudged down to like an 8 because I felt like I've done what I wanted to do?
Yeah, and what's changed, and what do I need now, and what's important to me? And
completely. I'm just going to give a couple examples, and I don't know if anything will come to mind, but if someone came to you and said, hey man, look, I'm really struggling in this part of my career, I'm looking for more purpose, right? And that's such a loaded word, right? But I just know I've met so many people that have come to me, especially when I moved to Chaitawa. A lot of people introduced me to their friends saying, hey, we've been working at Goldman Sachs, Procter & Gamble, like a bunch of like private companies or public companies. And they really like love what you did, and they just want to understand like how you thought about it. But, you know, and they assume that like I was a 10 out of 10. Of course, I'm not perfect in that way either, but I was definitely a lot more satisfied and fulfilled in my last role than I was in the role at Google. So like, just curious, like if someone came to you with that challenge, is there like a framework or something that you would like take them through to deal with?
Yeah, I always think that it's, I don't like frameworks, but I do think like in our business, there are techniques, and there are certain pathways that we can take. And so for me, like oftentimes when someone comes and they're saying, you know, like I'm unhappy at work, right? And I'll say, okay, well, why are you unhappy at work? Well, because I want more purpose. And I'll say, okay, well, what's important about purpose to you?
So you dig further into that.
And then we'll unpack what purpose means to them. And then through that, I'll listen, right? And then I'll say, okay, this is what I think I heard you say. Purpose is important for you because we're not going to be here forever. And so you want to feel like your time on earth is well spent. And then I'll reflect that back. And they'll say, yes, but kind of. And then he or she will then unpack more detail, and then so by the time you go back and forth and I keep on asking more of these questions, and then I'll say, okay, well, these three things that you just mentioned, like what's underneath those, tell me more. And so then you ultimately get to really the heart of matter, and like, sure, on the surface it might be unhappy with the job, and then what's known as like the presenting agenda. And then the deeper agenda is I want more purpose, right? And then there could be a transformational agenda underneath that.
Because often what you think it is isn't necessarily the case, right?
Exactly. Okay. And so that transformational agenda is often something that's like even more deeper than that. And so once you identify what that is, then there's a number of strategies and techniques that then can allow you to identify how you want to move forward.
Got it. Cool. That's helpful, man. Thank you. Yeah. I heard you tweeted this recently about the 360 review that you did.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've done one exactly like this, but I've had kind of experience where people give feedback on, you know, what you like to work with. I've done anonymous stuff. When I was a manager, I had people give upward feedback and stuff like that.
Sure.
Just take me through what that process is like, man. Because a lot of people on Twitter were saying, like, can you share details and what goes into this? And if you're happy to, even like some of the findings you found out about yourself that you weren't necessarily, you didn't think that would be the case.
Yeah, it was actually really interesting. So I have signed up to be certified in what's known as the Leadership Circle Profile. And so this is an organization that's been around for quite a while. And both my partners, Ben and Brad, also have gone through the profile themselves. And so I decided to go through it and also to get certified so that we can eventually offer it to our CEOs in our portfolio, which is going to be a great tool. We're really excited. And so the way that the profile works is that you share it with your bosses, your direct reports, and then peers. And it doesn't just need to be peers today, but also people that you've worked with in the past. And so I think I shared it with over 30 people. Oh, wow. So we have 10 employees at Primary today. And then I shared it with probably a handful of my former coworkers at RRE, and then a handful of founders that I was on the boards of.
And is it like a questionnaire?
So the way that it works, there's a quantitative aspect to it. And then there at the end, there's sort of three open text boxes, which is like, what's the one thing that just makes this person, I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, what's the one thing that they should keep on doing that makes them special? Then the second one is like one thing that would help their development. And then the third is there anything that this profile didn't address that is important for them to know?
Is it anonymous?
At the end of the day, like, the bosses are not. Okay. So, like, for example, Ben and Brad, my partners, I put them as my bosses.
Okay, so they, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because we're a partnership.
What they really
think. Yeah. And then for the peers and everyone else, it's completely anonymized.
Cool. I think that's important, because if you really want real feedback, it's hard with even your best friends or your loved ones. Like, even in your personal life, I think it's really important to get, or at least give people the option to be anonymous, because that way you get real feedback.
It's critical. I mean, it also, I think, preserves the relationships. I've seen organizations that haven't anonymized 360s, or the coach/facilitator did a really poor job anonymizing, and so people couldn't tell the results. And in those instances, it's been a disaster, because it erodes trust and the culture. That said, the results on this were, I think I could tell who made certain, but it's like, for me, that's okay, because this is an opportunity for me to learn and grow. And I'm still processing the results. I think, you know, in this, there's sort of like two main leadership dimensions, which on one end of the spectrum is creative and on the other is reactive. And the whole idea is you want to try to optimize the attributes in the creative sphere versus the reactive sphere. And so one could, and again, I haven't gone through my training yet, which I'm going to do in October when I get certified. But on the creative side, those are the ones that you really want to double down on. And on the reactive are the ones that you want to try to minimize or stop doing. Sure. And so for me, the one that was, I think, most surprising to me was distant.
Really? Okay.
And that wasn't what that was on the reactive scale, because I'm someone that actually, I think, tries to get to know people, and I'm pretty authentic. And for me, like, that was most surprising. And that's something that I think was worth digging into some more. I also got dinged on being arrogant, which it's interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah,
but look, I mean, I think it's something worth examining. For me, like, I struggle, and this is, I'm speaking openly, I struggle in big meetings that tend to be long. I've had, as I mentioned before the show, I have ADD. And so when meetings drag on, I can lose focus, and then I start like interrupting people. And for me, it's, I don't intend to do it, but of course, like, the what do they say? The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And so that's something that, you know, I've really taken to heart and that I'm going to work on. And then on the positive side, you know, it was kind of unanimous that extremely focused on community, extremely caring. And those were the two that, like, were clearly
outliers.
It's like, deeply cares about people, deeply cares about community.
Just to be a bit tactical here, was there like a tool or software that you guys use for this? Or
yeah, it's the Leadership Circle profile.
Oh, Leadership Circle.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Yeah. And so I worked with a coach, and, you know, they administer it, and they tabulate all the results, and then you sit down and review it. There's a report.
Very cool.
But overall, like, look, at the end of the day, and then there was a bunch of that was like more on like the quantitative aspect, and then the qualitative aspect where people were writing in comments. You know, it was actually really awesome, like, seeing all the positive things that people said about energy and great-hearted, good human being, amazing energy, like, huge, positive force in the New York tech ecosystem,
yeah, for sure.
Like, way more potential than he even knows that he has. But then on the flip side, you know, there were a bunch of other things about like losing focus in meetings. Okay. And
that's interesting because, yeah. I mean, I'm only obviously here with you. We are actually recording for some time. I hope that's all right.
Yeah.
But just to think through, like I've realized that being in a meeting, if you lose your focus, you're just naturally agitated, or someone else might be agitated, and your intention might not be that you're trying to be arrogant, but it might come across like that. So that's a very interesting.
Well, I think one-on-one for me is like a much better situation, because I think when you're sitting down with someone and it's just the two of you, it's way more intimate, as opposed to a meeting with 10 people that goes on for 4 hours. Can be tough. Although I just came from a board meeting of one of our portfolio companies that went for 3 hours, and I felt like I behaved myself.
Yeah, for sure, man. I know you'll have to make a move soon, but just to close out, I mean, first of all, thanks for sharing all of these. This has been really fascinating. I did want to call out, you mentioned the 360 review. I went through the purpose idea because I think that's a very common thing. One that people proactively are looking for.
It's actually something that I'm struggling with right now. And I've had open conversations with my partner, Ben and Brad, about it, which is like, I think in the case of being an investor, right, I say like we get a vote with our dollars to create the future that we want to see. Right. And that's really, I like to say investors really only have like three things in our control. It's the investment decisions we make. It's who we work for and how we spend our time. And, you know, and that's really all, because once we write the check, right? Like I'm a big believer that it's all up to the entrepreneur. That's not to say like I joined Primary because I believe they're the most active, hands-on, helpful VC in New York. And I also became a coach because I want to be helpful to founders. But like at the end of the day, I believe that a company's success and failure isn't about the investor. It's about all comes down to the founder. But coming back to it, the point around like my job as an investor is to meet with as many entrepreneurs as I can and to do a lot of email. Right. It's pretty much the job. It's meetings, email, and then a bunch of firm wide stuff. But that's the job. Right. And so for me, there are times where I've always asked myself, like, can you be a creative person in the role of an investor? Because your day is spent, you have so much demands for your time. Right. Other companies that want to pitch you, portfolio companies.
Podcasts,
people in the ecosystem, vendors, and there's only 10, 12, 14 hours in a day. And so for me, the thing that I struggle with most as an investor is just the time to be creative and get shit done. That's not just meetings and email.
Do you feel like you've gone itch to, you know, we didn't get to go into this too much, but you were going to start your own fund. Do you feel like you've got an itch for something like that, or even being operate as a startup founder?
No,
or something
I think
like that?
I think like my situation at Primary is an amazing one. Like I believe there are a few seed stage investors that have the future that we do. Like I really believe deeply in the firm, and given that we're so operationally focused and we roll up the sleeves, like I just love that mission because it's so service oriented in a way that I've never seen before, having worked at a number of institutions. Now that said, like as I'm about to enter my 40s, I'm getting old, like, and I have a kid at home, like it sort of shifts the mindset of like, oh my God, if I like as a partner of a fund, you know, we'll go out and raise our next fund, you know, within the next, call it 12 months or so. That's a 10-year commitment that I will need to make. And I think there's no better place to do venture in New York right now at the seed stage than Primary. But it's a question of like, okay, is this the impact that I want to have? Do I want to enable entrepreneurs and vote with dollars to enable change and impact? And impact being as like broadly defined as possible, versus like go and have that. Like, let me give you an example. This week I had surgery, or 2 weeks ago I had surgery. I'm like doing research on how to get a fast recovery. And I discovered through my research of like what's going to help me pre-surgery, because I had four or five days before my surgery. And then I knew it was going to be a 3-month recovery. So I was like, what's going to help me before and afterwards? And I came across this form of like hypnotherapy, but specifically around healing and recovery around surgeries. And so I started doing research, and there's studies that say that it's incredibly effective, both in terms of like reducing anxiety pre-operation, pre-surgery. And then post-surgery, it like increases recovery by like 20-25%. And so then I start like researching it, and I was like, wow, like there's actually an opportunity. You have all of these like super generic mindfulness apps that are all competing, Calm and Headspace and 10% Happy. I actually think they're all great companies, but like it's relatively commoditized, where I was like, look, you could do a whole hypnotherapy mindfulness around like helping people prepare and recover from surgery. And like that's an example where it's like, not saying I would go quit my job at Primary, but you just don't have that ability.
It's ownership, like full ownership in that. You have ownership of what you're doing at Primary to a certain extent.
But not a create. It's like not, yeah, it's, there's a different level. It's not as, like you don't have the creative freedom and flexibility. Although at Primary, we do have an incubation arm. Okay. So my partner Ben runs point on that. He's a phenomenal entrepreneur, and he's been an entrepreneur for over 20 years. So there is an opportunity to build. It's just the question is, you know, do you want to be secondary versus primary? But I'm in a great situation. I think that to be able to invest and then also have my coaching practice, and as I get more experience, find ways to integrate, to basically, you know, combine that Venn diagram of VC and a coach and be able to really offer these kinds of things into the portfolio.
It definitely like helps what I always think about that with what I'm doing right now as well. It's just like the multiplication of two or three things coming together.
Right.
And it sounds so cliche, but when 1 + 1 + 1 isn't 3,
yeah,
it's a lot more, because you're going to be a much better partner as a VC because of the coaching and vice versa. I feel the same about the way, you know, I get to sit here for 2 hours with you and talk about all this amazing stuff, not because of the money I make from the podcast, but because this knowledge will compound and this relationship will compound over time. And that is the main reason I do it.
Yeah, I can't wait to sit down and grab coffee.
Yeah, 100%.
So man, I can get some help to launch my own podcast.
Yeah, 100%. The last question I will ask is just on, you mentioned anxiety there, and
sure,
you also mentioned you used to self-medicate with smoking a little Mary Jane back in the day. So I'm just curious, because it's such a huge issue right now, and so many people are suffering from anxiety. And I'm just curious, have you found tools, mechanisms to be able to cope with it now over time?
It's interesting. So about 2 months ago, I actually, I've had what I would consider mild anxiety most of my life. It's what I get for being Jewish.
Yeah.
But well, I, for the first time in my life, maybe about 2 months ago, I had actually really severe anxiety, and had a panic attack. And because I was having health issues that the doctors couldn't diagnose. This was separate from my shoulder. I was having chest pains, and they basically did all the tests and basically couldn't, or they're like, you're perfectly healthy. I mean, work out almost every day, meditate, sleep, get a fair amount of sleep.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
but you still know that feeling's there though, right?
In
the chest, the heaviness in the chest.
Exactly. And that was giving me a lot of anxiety, because I felt like there was something wrong with me, yet all these doctors. And so it was the first time where it was like real severe anxiety, waking up in the middle of the night, like, you know, not being able to go to bed for long periods of time, thinking that there's something physically wrong with me. And, you know, eventually I had to look, and I did some work with Andrew, my philosopher, coach, whatever you want to call him, around this notion of death. Because I think that was what was causing the anxiety, which was my fear of death. So what I had to do is actually like go and stare death in the face. So he recommended a book called The Five Invitations. I'm not going to try to pronounce the author's last name, but it's an amazing book. And you know, what I did is I basically had to look at that and really figure out why that was giving me a lot of anxiety. Now, that didn't help with my physical pain, but it certainly calmed my nerves. And what I would say overall, what I've done over the years, certainly since right before I got sober and certainly the 4 years since, is try to have a daily meditation practice, eat well, get enough sleep,
get the basics
eat
right.
well. And it, for the most part, the anxiety stays in check. But to me, it's one of those things that, you know, at the end of the day, it's also like not overwork myself, yeah. right? Like the older I get, the more I'm like, I can't work 12 to 13, 14 hours a day. Yeah. I just can't. And so it's, how do I fit the most amount of productivity into a 10-hour day? And if I work on the weekends, which I do every weekend, but it's not like I'm grinding and trying to burn. It's like, I guess the word that I'm trying to get at is balance.
Yeah, that's the key.
And so that's been, you know, I think for me, that's what has helped with my anxiety. But the anxiety when it came to my health situation and death, I like literally had to go and like stare it in the face and change my perspective on it.
Are you still scared of death?
No, I actually think through the work that I've done over the last few months, I actually appreciate life way more.
Because I
realize, look, the reality is we're all destined for the same fate. And if I realize that this day is the only one of its kind, I'll appreciate it a lot more.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And so, like, yeah. in some ways, by embracing death has allowed me to live more fully and presently. Yeah. Which, with this shoulder injury, also has been amazing, because the old Steve would have been in bed trying to work and be on my phone and taking calls. And I was like, you know what? I'm just actually going to relax. And I'm going to let my body heal. And I'm going to actually read a fiction book. I read a great book called George Washington Black. And I'm not going to stress myself out. And I'm going to focus on healing my body. And I'll go back to work when I'm ready. And then I'll ramp back up. So I was like, in that moment post-surgery, I'm laying in the bed. I'm like, you know what? Rather than making myself feel guilty, just going to embrace it, and I'm going to take each day. I'm not going to try to focus on me being healthy in 4 months. I'm not going to look back and say, what if I did this differently and didn't get into a bike accident? It was just like, let me just relax and be in the moment.
Yeah. That's a great way to finish off, man. Yeah. I appreciate this so much. I know I didn't want you to be late to see your
Yeah,
your
I want
daughter,
to put my
but,
daughter to sleep.
Really appreciate it. We should definitely do this again, yeah. and we should definitely grab the coffee. So thanks for coming on. Again, I want to thank our host today, Listening Party in Canal Street Market, for hosting us here in New York every week. And if you're listening to this on the podcast, please make sure you go on youtube.com/ CreatorLab FM, and you can subscribe and watch all the videos and the clips, and we're across all social, of course, CreatorLab FM, and please tell a few friends if you're enjoying these. I'm back on the road with this every 2 weeks on a Wednesday. You'll get new episodes, so please keep spreading the word. And that's it, man. Thanks so much, my man. Appreciate it.
Thank all you right. for having
Cheers.
Me thanks
Bye-bye.
So much.
I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. And please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm, or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.